Hello and welcome to No Killing Goblins. I'm Dragonus, and this is, of course, as always, Oshin.
Hi, everybody.
And today we are going to be digging into, I think, probably the most important chapter of the whole book, and then also this other chapter that isn't about Floss.
There are words I would like to say right now to you, but they're not said in polite company. Just
I don't think this qualifies as polite company, but
I'm
regardless.
sorry, I respect our listeners and I'm a genteel, cultured person. My porn comes from reading, it doesn't come from pictures. I'm just saying. But we are doing some very exciting chapters this week. They are as I don't even know how to say that. They are the best chapters in the volume, in volume two, and I was surprised. I completely forgotten we were coming up to them. I can't wait to talk about them, but before we even get into it, how's your week been?
I had a week. Feels like I've always had a week. It's just been more of the same work, some lingering technical issues that had to be fixed, so on and so forth.
How's your computer doing now since the
Everything's working, and I don't want to jinx it.
hard like as much as I detest the fact that every 3 years I have to buy a new laptop, honestly, I don't mind that my issues aren't as like devastating as often as it is for like hard drive like desktop users because they can replace parts, but it could take weeks. Months. I just go out and buy a fucking new one. I'm good.
I mean, replacing the power supply only took a few days, and even then, it's only because I was cheap and ordered it one online for like cheaper than I could have gotten if I went and just had it fixed the next day, or bought it and then fixed it myself the next day, really. But anyways, yeah, I've had that power supply for about a decade, so I think I got my money's worth out of it. And it
Speaking of weeks and fixing things quickly. I have been feeling dread all week because the volume 8's about to end, and the last batch of chapters is just so scary. I don't know why, but they are scary. They're really epic, but they're also super scary. It's like putting us through the emotional ringer, and I don't know where I am at this. And in between all of that, I've been try I recorded something last week with Casual Farmer, which I mentioned in the last episode. It's gonna be a little late because it was a little messy at the start because of technical issues, so we re-recorded some stuff and I'm working on editing it now and I'll probably release it this week. I promise, for reals. Speaking of the editing though, we had a volunteer come help edit for us last week. Just a shout out to Liquid Ender for taking the time and just doing this for us because we are so behind and we really did need the help. And if anybody else out there wants to volunteer to help us, please do anything because yeah, Dragonus has a life and a lot of shit to do, and I have not much better, but I can't talk about any of my shit. Ugh, it's a my God, I hate family.
Yeah, family sucks.
God. How was Easter for you, actually?
It was actually, all right. I went and saw some family, ate some free food, and made nice conversation, and then all of the screaming children showed up, and I politely said my goodbye and left.
Isn't that
It was a good couple hours.
oh I don't know, I've been thinking this is the stupidest thing, but I've actually been thinking more and more about canceling like streaming service stuff. It's the dumbest conversation to have right now, but honestly it's what's been the it is what has been on my mind recently. There's a bunch of streaming services that why don't I just pay on the month that I want to watch and then the rest of the time I just don't pay? Like, I don't know why I'm paying every month. This is like a really bad cable bill. Paying $40 a month for all these streaming services.
Yeah, I don't. I think yeah, I have HBO Max 'cause it's cheap and I use it often enough. Peacock just comes with my Comcast because I hate Comcast, but I'm stuck with them. And yeah, I just don't pay for any others. If I want to watch something, I turn it on for a month.
Yeah, it's just I don't know. I should probably be switching, but it's just I like the convenience of knowing that whenever I want, I can just turn it on. But then I can just pay for it whenever I want. So what is the difference? What is that psychological stopper?
It just sounds like laziness.
It does.
Just a little. But like, I don't know. I sometimes waffle on HBO Max, but I was convinced to keep it recently because they've had a new show on there called Julia about Julia Child, and it's been amazing.
Oh.
I recommend it to anyone.
Oh my God, I love Julia. I love Julia Child in general. I grew up watching cooking shows because PBS was the only like channel that had anything decent on all the time. And I was fascinated with cooking shows when I was a kid. And Julia Child and Jacques Pepin were like the pair. They did this one of the most insane things memories from my childhood is sitting down on a Sunday and my brother, my mom, and me were like eating food and stuff, and we were watching Jacques Pepin and Julia, and they had this giant ostrich egg, and that woman like cracked it with a mallet and opened it up, and it was this huge ugly ass thing. It's like they were making omelets. It was all omelets. It was a lot of fun. Okay, I could go on and on.
Yeah. Anyways, yeah, it's great. If you like Julia Child at all, you really should watch this. It's a little bit dramatized, but for the most part, it's a pretty faithful capturing of her and who she was and how she got the show started and all of like the hurdles and difficulties she had to overcome. Not the least of which is the fact that back then nobody took TV seriously at all.
It was interesting. They did what am I gonna say this? They did introduce it's a very WASP show. Like if you watch it, it's very much for a WASP pair. The fun thing about it is that they represent Julia and Julia's husband, whose name is like bl I'm blanking on it for a second because I'm me. And the two of them are very like romantic and they're older and they're retired, but they're seen as like this vital couple, and that's kind of cool, and I liked it.
It's very true to who they actually were, and you know, because he was such a quiet, behind the scenes, not very like you know, loud person who was actually really happy to have the spotlight off of him. It's not really, I think, as clear to a lot of people, but he really did do a lot for both the show and the cookbooks and making recipes. Like he was very involved and very supportive, and they were both very artistic people. And like they were very much a team. And I do appreciate that they capture that these two people are just ride or die for each other in a really waspish way. Which, I mean, let's face it, like they were absolutely giant super mega wasps.
And it shows, I mean, everything about the show. The speaking of HBO Max shows though, the ones I've been like super fascinated by recently is The Flags Means the Flat Our Flag Means Death on HBO, which is a it's about pirates, but it's literally based it's by Taika Waititi, and he's just a really hilarious comedian and a producer of films, and he made What We Do in the Shadows, and he created this show, and it's based off a real like it's a period romantic comedy, quote unquote, but it's with pirates, and it's loosely based on the life story of Stede Bonnet, who is an actual guy who like abandoned his aristocratic life with a comfortable family, bought a ship, and went out and became a pirate during the golden age of piracy, despite having no aptitude for piracy whatsoever. Like and the show it
Yeah,
go ahead.
I was gonna say that show is on my list. It does sound like it's going to be pretty great. Although I'm having trouble because I would probably have to wait for Julia to be over because the new anime season is a banger, and I've been looking forward to Spy Family forever. So like the free hour-ish I have a week to watch TV is accounted for.
The whole it's all out, by the way. I think it's 10 episodes, and 10 episodes is out, so you can just watch the whole thing. I loved it. I don't know if there'll be a second season. You know how Bridgerton exists, and it's this, and everybody's like criticizing it because it's not historically accurate. But but the response to that is it's not supposed to be historically accurate. It's a fucking fantasy. Our Flags Means Death is a fantasy too, and it's just. I don't want to spoil stuff, but it, and I don't want to talk about too much about like
I mean,
plot
it's
details.
called a period drama for a reason.
Yeah.
Anyway, before
Yeah.
we get caught too much on all of the other media that we love to consume and talk about nonstop, let's talk about this media we like to consume and talk about
Ooh,
nonstop.
yeah, but we have emails. We should do emails. We
Yeah,
should do emails.
before we do emails, we do have somebody who commented to us on the Discord because, quote, I'm lazy. Sorry, Rosie, but I mean, you said it. Rosie, who is apparently a deeply knowledgeable person about music and music theory, explained to us the difference between sol and so in the do re mi fa thing, and it really is just linguistic drift. It was sol, it still gets written as sol sometimes, most people say so. Nothing terribly complicated. There is, in fact, no lizard man conspiracy.
Rosie, by the way, that wasn't sarcastic. Rosie actually is went to school for music and is actually working in is a classical musician and is trained in it, so she knows.
Oh, yeah, no sarcasm intended. If I came across at all as being sarcastic about like Rosie's qualifications, I apologize.
And we have two emails to read, one from Seth Haito and one from a D Donkey Monkey. I'll read Donkey Monkeys if you don't mind.
Go
Okay.
for it.
Donkey Monkey sent us and said, "You said to send this as an email, so here's what I sent in the TWI Talk server with a small addition. I'm currently listening to the Food Law episode, and I don't know if anyone said this already, but I don't know if if the mayo thing was just Pava's lack of knowledge. In the isekai and lit RPG I've read, the protagonist introducing mayonnaise as something new and impressive is weirdly common. Like whenever an isekai protagonist is introducing a new condiment, if it's not soy sauce, it's mayo." And often it's both, with ketchup being a less common option that I don't think I've seen without soy sauce and or mayo having already been introduced or being introduced at the same time. So I'm not saying Pava doesn't lack in knowledge, in in-depth knowledge of mayo, it's just surprisingly common in the genre. In addition, I don't disagree that it's stupid to think that something like mayonnaise, both new and so impactful like that, is in many isekai and lit RPG stories. I just wanted to point this out because I think it's interesting that it's so common. Not just the trope of introducing a new condiment, but also how often it's mayo. Thank you for your time, Donkey 2012 Glory Craze Theorist as the class in brackets. That's pretty fucking cool. Here's my response to that. I had not realized it until you pointed it out. But anytime food is meant, yeah, he's not wrong. I mean,
This is weird to me because I don't really think of that as something I've seen come up in a lot of isekai I've watched, and I've like read and watched a lot of them, and it might just be something that's gone over my head, but it's not ringing a bell.
in things like Beware of Chicken, he tries to make soy sauce and rice wine and all these things, and like not does he doesn't do kit. Like ketchup or anything, the main character Jin. But I just realized that mayonnaise would be one of the few things that everybody knows, thinks is this magical concoction that came out that requires a lot of work and effort to produce. And technically, it did. Mayonnaise wasn't something that was common. It's an emulsification, it's very simple, but it was usually done by people who were making like food for others, less. For people at home, because you didn't always have all the ingredients and you didn't always know what to do, but I don't know. I thought it
So
was.
the ingredients themselves aren't so hard, but it doesn't keep well and it is somewhat wasteful.
Yeah.
So if you're not making it to like consume right then and there and you're willing to waste like, some valuable eggs for some mayo,
Yeah.
then yeah. But like, I don't know, it's neither here nor there. I guess it's just one of those bits of the genre that's always missed me.
One of the things that I recently read on Reddit that kind of blends into this a little bit is somebody posted a thread, if you saw it, on the TWI Discord about how there's a lack of representation for those who are poorer, who are less, who are economically disadvantaged, Basically, all the Earthers that are introduced early on come from a socioeconomic background of either being wealthy or at least middle class. Even like everyone is. And I realize that maybe that's true. I don't know.
I think there's too much we don't know about
Yeah.
some other Earthers. I don't know if I think that that's true the whole way through. Actually, you know what? It occurs to me that I really think it's not true because a couple Earthers that we meet in the chapters we're going to talk about are described multiple times as being not very well off.
Yeah, and even without that, what it brought out to me wasn't that particular comment, but it made me think about it for a little bit, and I realized that a lot of the writers of lit RPGs and isekais and stuff, they write from their own background, and that tends to be upper middle class, wealthy, privileged backgrounds, and they don't necessarily know what it's like to be poor. It's fairly rare to read someone talking about what it is like to experience the life of being poor. Like, I know of one story on Royal Road that actually accurately depicts what it's like to be poor, and that's Read Trailer Trash. Like, living with less food and less ability and less, and being looked down upon and having to deal with, deadbeat parents and then having, like, your cousin stay because their parents are gonna be disappearing for a while and they have nowhere else to go and you have to take them in because that's what you do for family, but. Like, and then you having to stretch through.
Some, but I don't know. I can think of isekai where it hasn't been just that, but I think that part of this comes from the fact that at least in Japan, the stereotype for most isekai protagonists is either very young, like high schoolish age teenager who is, somewhere in roughly exactly middle class and too boring to comment on otherwise. Or what the one that I always think of, which is the really common, utterly failed older person who is a salaryman who hates themselves and
Right.
hates their lives and hates their job because they're trapped in this perpetual system that grinds them up and spits them out because Japan is highly conformist and kind of can
Oh my
suck.
God, the amount of.
And that turns into just like its own sort of stereotype of the person who is unfulfilled and wants to go back and becomes self-perpetuating to the point where even people who are not that guy are writing about, that guy, regardless of, who they are otherwise, because it's the stereotype and it sells. And, it's a whole thing. Genres are weird.
Dude, I know. I mean, it's super common in anime and manga, and it's become very reflective in the last decade or so. There's like Agretsuko, I think it's called, on Netflix, where it's literally,
Agretzuko.
yeah, Agretsuko, where it's like it's hyper stylized, but it is literally somebody talking about living and working in Japan and what it's like to just exist in that extreme. And there's so many shows that are copies of that. And it's not, go ahead.
I watched the first season of that. I keep meaning to watch more of it, but Netflix I turn on very rarely for watching stuff. But we do have another email from Seth Hayato, who made a couple good points of some stuff that we said, which is apparently when we were confused about what QEC meant, it is really obvious in retrospect. They probably meant QED. It's like, I didn't know this, but they put it at the end of mathematical proofs. I just thought it was something you said at the end of a sentence to indicate you were done and were feeling smug that day because you just made a good point or something.
There's he also mentions an answer to our question about what the like Dylan and I asked, I think, what the ending song should be after Aaron's party. What do you think? Normally, Seth says ending song. Normally, I would say you would want the last song to be a classic and a grand finale type song. However, given that it takes place at an inn, the true ending song would have to be Closing Time by Semisonic. Solid choice.
Yeah, no, that one's a classic. It makes sense. And it is, a great multi-purpose song. Just about any time you want people to leave, you put that on and everyone gets the hint.
Yeah, and there is something that Seth mentions that haunts me since this happened. The party happens, Ryoka joins in, they play modern music on a modern device that references, I don't know, a billion things that are only available on Earth. Like playing, they did Hey There, Delilah, or anyway, Everything. Delilah, planes, trains, cars, machines, guns. Another one, Bites the Dust alone, has like definitely. I didn't really think about it.
And religious turns, apologize, heaven and
Oh
angel,
my God, yeah.
what Seth said, all it takes is someone like Grimalkin in the crowd to make it a problem. And I agree that there is a degree of they weren't thinking there, but let's face it, Ryoko was exhausted, there was a lot going on, and Eren is kind of a force of nature.
Oh, yeah.
Eren has a certain bowling you over property, and once the party starts going, not even Ryoka can stay grumpy. Not when, there's just so much going on.
Yeah.
And honestly, given how radical and new most of just the music would have been, I'm betting the lyrics went over like 99% of the people's their heads anyways. And anybody who did catch something weird just chalked it up to, I don't know, this is a weird setting, there's magic and bullshit, and maybe they've just never heard of this New York place before. They'll ask about it tomorrow, then wake up with a hangover wondering what they meant to ask
There
about.
was some speculation that Olesome probably picked up on all of it and figured it out, and he just doesn't talk about it. And it's like he secretly knows about everything but doesn't say anything because he's trying to be polite. It's like the ending of Daria when Quinn reveals that Daria is her sister to her friends, and they're like, "Oh, we knew. We were just being polite about it." Because she spends the entire series telling everybody her sister is like this weird girl that hangs out with her. Okay. But nobody gets that reference. I'm sorry. Let's talk about the
Yeah, let's say so. This chapter starts out in just such a low-key, relaxed way. Eren just picking a dandelion, enjoying the breeze, realizing that like the grass outside, when it's not a well-manicured lawn, kind of sucks to sit on.
And she, I mean, I can't even tell you how much the A beginning sequence is both beautiful and terrible at the same time. Oh, Pirate's gonna kill me for this. But it's so well developed in terms of like setting it up, executing it. It's a dream sequence. And you just think she picks up that fucking sword, man, and the whole Fae speaking to her, it's only a dreaming. I don't understand how she did it. To this day, I don't understand how she did it. Do you?
I have a thought, and actually, I think that mostly so the Fae is trying to visit her in her dream so it can talk her into giving her all of her sugar and pulling a fast one and running on the technicality of, well, she said that I could take it all, and I think that connection, plus the fact that like at the end of the day, Eren is. I feel like Eren is genuinely somebody who could pick up that sword in real life if it wasn't a
I
dream,
mean,
which it kind of halfway wasn't anyways, but
yeah,
like.
but so I apologize. I wasn't clear about my question. What I meant is, Eren is able to dream of this world, and in the dream, she invited the Fae. I don't think the Fae can. I mean, the stories are that the Fae can, like, twist your dreams and all that, but this, it just doesn't seem like something the Fae would bother with. And asking for sugar, why? These are some pretty abrasive and demanding people, and they are now officially guests. So it doesn't seem like they would give a shit about her dreams. They just want, if they want the sugar, they just ask for the sugar.
Oh no, it's not that simple. She still needs to ask for the sugar, and I think she was doing it in a dream, and that had unintended side effects.
Don't know.
But
Okay.
I also think that like maybe the how isn't as important given the rest of this
Oh,
chapter,
that's true.
because this chapter is about the wonder of magic, the unexplained, the beautiful, the mysterious. There's a certain point where I think asking too much about the how undercuts the why and the meaning, which to my mind, this whole section is to set up what I think is this whole chapter's big thesis and theme, which is Eren being the chosen one doesn't mean having to take up a sword.
I don't think of that as a thesis. For me, the thesis of the chapter, well, there's two parallel storylines, and we could probably I mean, before we dive any deeper into the larger one, at least the one focused on Eren, I think we should at least mention the more subtle, smaller one that's going. Well, it's not really that subtle. What am I saying? Krishai's whole dramatic situation where she loses her business that she's worked for her whole life to this terrible human girl who blew it up, and that's not Eren. And said human girl gets caught and taken away to jail, and we now know who this girl is that keeps being mentioned and who did all those magic things, and it's described who she is and that she's some rich kid's daughter who's been running around. She was trying to keep from starving, and at the same time she did these horrible things, and Krishai is just broken. Her life work was burned up in an instant.
Yeah, and it really does not help that it's so very few humans live here. So much blowback hits Eren too, and Kershaya is just very kind to Eren, but
You can only, I mean, it only extends so far. No matter how kind you are to experience that loss. I mean, if that happened to me, if my entire life's work, if the thing I'd spent everything I had and every day on, the thing that defined me a little bit, because she's defined by it. She's a merchant. She does this work.
it is her
It
class.
is her class. She just, they took it away from her in an instant, in a ball of flame. It was really sad to read. But on the flip side, while all of this going on, as we were mentioning, Eren decides to ask the Fae after she wakes up about how could she be, can she really be magic? That's the thing that hit me. For me, it wasn't whether she's a chosen one or not, it's whether or not she can be magic.
Maybe the phrase chosen one isn't exactly correct, because I don't think that Eren is like a prophesied chosen one or anything like that. If anything, I think Eren is just. This is something I have a lot of trouble trying to describe. I think that Eren is genuinely special. I think that she is the right person at the right time because she just is that person and wouldn't live in a world where she's not that person. As weird and as goofy and as dense on purpose or not as she can be, she's driven. When she sees something that bothers her, she won't not deal with it. And I think that this opens up with her hypothetically pulling out Caliburn and, the generic isekai, I've pulled out the sword, I will now take classes in king, and I will be the great swordsman who rights wrongs and fights justice, and I'll be that. Meanwhile, that's not Eren. Eren wants to be magical. She wants to bring joy to people and understand them and become their friends and be a peacekeeper. She is an innkeeper, and by being an innkeeper and putting together this delicious meal of the Fae that she does with all this wonder and joy, this is the story declaring this is how Eren will, I hope, one day save the world. By being an innkeeper, because being an innkeeper does not mean being powerless.
My interpretation of the chapter was a little different. I mean, of course, it was different. It's a different person. For me, it was seeing somebody ask the question that I would ask. I don't believe myself to be capable of some kind of ma I think about it all the time, like what class you would be and all those things, and you wonder and you wish you could be a shapeshifter, but really at the core of it, all you want to do is just be able to touch magic. There's a moment in the chapter where Eren just asks the particular phase that she started, who's never named, by the way. I don't think we name her, but just asked to touch her. And it seems simple, but when you really think about it, that's what at the core that we want, to touch magic, to be close to it, to see, to wonder, to feel that specialness, even if you don't believe you're capable of yourself. And sometimes that's all it is. It's about that little desire to like hold close to you and just be a part of something unreal and magical, to dance with the Fae, to cook for them, and have them laugh and join and be merry and sing with you and invite you into the mystery of yesterday, into those fairy mounds where like you could be joyful and magical, and it would be a night that stays with you forever, and it's the tiniest bit of magic. And Erin gets to share in that experience. She gets to touch magic that isn't. She gets to touch magic. And that was what I thought of. That's what I thought about this chapter. Because in that moment, Erin was me. She didn't try to become the sword-wielding hero, like you said, but that wasn't even the important bit. Important bit was she expressed that truthful desire, and when she, and she tried for it. In the chapter, like, she gains the skill Wondrous Fair at the end, and it's green, another green thing. She and it's clear that it's tied to her ability to create things for, like food for other people, because Wondrous Fair is, objects or something, whatever it's got to be. And she gains that because she does this, and it, what she does is not unaccomplishable, you know? It's something anyone could do. It's something any child does. They serve little tea sets, and you forget that when you get older. You lose that, and she didn't. She touched magic. She was magic. It wasn't about mages and anything. It was just about how holding that little bit of wonder.
I'd say she went beyond touching magic. I'd say she made magic. She created wonder. She took this deep disappointment that she felt when Pisces told her that she couldn't learn magic and didn't have the mana for it, and found her own way
Yeah.
to like continue to be wondrous and bring wonder to people.
It's wonderful. I mean, it really is beautiful. There's nothing a lot to say from my part on the prose or on the structure or anything like that. It really was a simple chapter where she speaks to the Fae, wants to serve them food, and get some help from her friends to do it, and she makes a special meal and gains a special skill, and then they promise her remuneration for it, and she wakes up and she thinks the gold they gave her is enough, and then she looks at it and it's flowers.
Which absolutely, I like. Everybody had to have seen this coming, and I kept expecting her to call them out on it because this whole time she's like a step ahead of them, putting this meal together, calling them in. She gets them caught up in this party because, like I said, she can be a force of nature. And at the end of this moment, she just takes the gold unthinkingly because this dream state, and I do think the prose did a great job of capturing the dreamlike fairies dancing through the room, feasting quality to it. And then it's all flowers.
I love the next to last line. The magic ended. Erin stared at the wilting golden flowers. Her left eye twitched. She took a deep breath, and then she screamed, "What the fuck?"
Oh, yeah, no. And you know, with her skill, that what the fuck had to have been heard for
I mean,
miles.
I would have screamed, "What the fuck?" But then again, I knew better than to think the Fae would ever pay me without tricking me.
Oh, no, they'll totally pay you if you call them out on it. She just didn't. That said, like, you know, as time goes on, I think that what she gains from this is more than any gold could have compensated
Yeah,
for.
sure.
And I would have said a lot more than just what the fuck. I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, I totally believe that Pirate cut us off there because Erin spent the rest of the day cursing. Well, I don't really have much else to say about the chapter. It's just one of those things that you should just experience by reading. It isn't a cr like I'm not gonna critique it a lot. So I'm gonna move on to the comments of Pirate Opposite.
I there's one thing that I would say, and you know, my memory of this chapter is so much bigger than the chapter. I felt like it was longer, but when I read it, I realized that I think there could have been more space for maybe a more modern writery or pirate to expand it out and really kind of capture the minutiae and nuance of the moment.
It should
Not
have been like the scenes themselves, the imagery that Pirate was trying to evoke could have been expanded. But I try not to judge on that aspect with Pirate ABBA because early on they didn't know how to quite expand. And even now it takes a lot more like it takes them a lot to expand it. Like the recent chapter there was the difference between before and now is so in the recent chapter they had a scene where a particular person does a grand act of magic, but and it's beautifully described, and then when you look back to the older, it might have just been described as they cast fireball, something like that. And I think it's a typical of the writing style that they were leaning on, and they were just copying what other people were doing and trying to work through it. You learn how to expand on images, and Pirate wasn't there yet.
And on the subject of Pirate, Pirate's comment in this, what stands out to me is Pirate saying that they wanted to put as much magic into it as the best scenes they've ever read, and then quotes the "You're a wizard, Harry" bit, which is, I think Pirate nailed it.
I do too. I mean, it was honestly, it was very, very well done because they understood what the scenes are about. It's not about the particulars of who dances where or what. It's that wondrous moment. I keep going back to the phrase touching meant. That's what it was for me.
Also, a pirate sort of soliciting some ideas for a better idea than quote the magical cooking, which was the original skill. And yeah, no, Wondrous Fair just is perfect. This is one of the things I really love about web serials and just that sort of accessibility back and forth with the author, is they can just ask, like, "Hey, I've got this idea for a class name or a skill name, but I need to zazz it up a little. Hive mind, get on that."
And the person who helped Pyre come up with the name is indeed not.
And indeed, if indeed not is still around, I would love to like send you a hearty thank you.
I'm sure they're still around, but did you? Okay, let's take a few seconds and just go through the comments. Did you find anything you wanted to use?
Nothing super stood out to me.
Oh, wait. Okay, Pirate referenced Fate Stay Night, but I don't think we're gonna talk about it. It's not a good joke.
I noticed several Fate Stay Night references in this chapter. I was just keeping to
No,
myself.
I figure, yeah, let's do that. But there is one comment that I'll point out. Ayumi blog on May 3rd, 2017 says, "As soon as they offered gold, quote unquote, I knew it was a lie. Oh, it so helps to know the stories." I feel.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I would say, I mean, Aerith did know them, but when you're in one, it can be hard to notice that you've suddenly crossed over into that realm.
I mean, no. Okay. I have a serious. I'm going to make a sweeping generalization that anyone can correct me on, but if you're of Irish descent or Celtic descent, you're probably going to know enough not to get tricked by the Fae. At least not this obviously. And, living in New York, I am exposed to way too many Irish people. It just, I had to learn by osmosis.
I think that even if you were like living in the woods next to one of those fairy mounds that I'm told they refuse to pave over just in case, full-blown like Irish, and you in real life just stumbled straight into some fairies, you might just have that mental record scratch that lets them slip one by you. Because I mean, they're supposed to be good at this, right? Like.
I mean, someone does mention that she got 4 new levels and 2 new skills. So I guess technically that was payment enough.
Yeah. Also, God, part of me wonders if they didn't make such a lame, "Here's your giant pile of gold," wink attempt because they were hoping that she might be able to like argue back and get a real reward out of it. Because you know, it's kind of their nature. They can't just give her straightforward money, I think, even if they wanted to.
And if she did ask for it, it would give them a chance to play games. To, I mean, that's what Fae do in the end, right? Well, we can't quite pay you. And what kind of payment could you possibly ask of the Fae? Gold is not enough. Do you not trust us? Blah blah blah. You know, play the game of mind game and force her into doing more amusing things for them. It's what Fae typically do to mortals. And Like we've seen the Fae that as they've been represented being pretty nasty, so I think Pirate actually did Erin a favor by having her not question it, because I feel like maybe that would have led her to more of a mess. All
Maybe.
right, you lead us into the next chapter.
And of course, it's time for Oshi's favorite character and favorite thing to talk about, introduced, I think, for real this chapter, Floss and his Magnificent Seven-ish.
There's a line from a Seanan McGuire book about how oaths used to have like value and stuff, and when someone said something, they genuinely meant that this would happen if their oath failed. Let me say this. If my dick was dipped in acid, I would still enjoy that more than some of these Floss chapters. And
I mean, there's what's your specific problem with this one then?
my specific problem with this one was within 5 seconds, I called that he would have a court of really super powerful. I actually thought they would all be women. That was a surprise. They weren't women. He did have a few men in there, which was interesting. But I called that he would have a court of really busty women. I called that he would be super powerful. I called that he would revive himself and he'd go back on an event. Like, it was nothing surprising. That's the greatest sin to me for Floss. I don't hate Floss the person, the character, so much as I hate the predictability of his character. Does that make sense?
I don't I'm not going to agree. If nothing else, three of that four were openly stated in the last chapter. It's hardly calling anything. And given that he was the King of Destruction, as we were told at the end of that last one, and everything we knew from Ghazi, of course he was going to have a suite of powerful retainers. I still liked this one though, because they all came across as interesting. They all felt like they were their own real characters. I would have liked to have gotten to know our involved Earthers in the situation a bit more myself, but I think that there's, more better chapters to get to know them, and that this one had to do a lot of heavy lifting, introducing us to Floss and his, God, what is it, five now? No, four.
Yeah, four. Yeah.
Four. Because, and actually, I still to this day feel the loss of getting to know Drevish as a character. I feel like he would have been really interesting and maybe helped round out this group. Because the ones we know of that are alive really do seem to trend towards more direct melee battle-y types.
And you think Drevis would have been what?
Well, we do get to find out some stuff about him over time, but he seemed to be more of a thinker, less of a direct person, more creative. I would have liked to have just, I don't know, gotten to know him. It would have maybe made this feel like it had a bit more punch to it. And obviously, the setup of what happens to him, head in a box, would not have worked if we had met him with them first, but I would love to have gotten like an interlude or some kind of like perspective on him so that we would feel this loss a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say from a plot standpoint, this chapter does do a lot of heavy lifting. It establishes Trey and Terrace a little bit more. It establishes that Ghazi tells Floss all about Erin, and that Erin creates a connection between Erin and Floss. Possibly, it takes the time to establish the names of all of the seven that are out there, including Drevish and Amaris, who we don't meet yet. Talks about the various different unique, I don't know, legions that Floss can call on. The Forgotten Legion, the Silent Marchers, Sunless
Or
Ghosts, blah blah blah, Grave
at
Wardens.
least try to call on, as the case may be. And I do actually appreciate that one of the things this chapter opens up on and constantly reminds us of is that Eren fucked Ghazi up.
Oh yeah, the eye thing. Ooh.
Oh, God, it still makes me twitch and shudder to think about it. And it is actually really interesting to get more of a look into Gazi's mind and see what she's like when she's not being a creepy stalker. I did enjoy like the seven all being kind of cool and a little bit different and unique. Mars the Thirst Trap, Takahetris, I or Takatris,
Petrus.
however his name gets
Okay.
pronounced, is another character I really want to see more of. And he came off as a little bit interesting, a little bit mysterious, really cool. I just wanted more, but I think that's a sign of like a good chapter that introduces all these new perspectives needs to make me want more.
I when I read the first when I read the first K chapter, I met sorry, excuse me. When I read the first K chapter and then this one, I just saw a reflection of a typical anime storyline, and I have an allergic reaction to a lot of the anime shonen storylines. And I don't know, Flo's felt like that, and each of the seven felt like a member of his posse that was also part of the seven. And the new kids on the block suddenly arrive from nowhere, and they're being taught who they are, and they're going out like fairy tale and whatnot. Like they're rebuilding the power of it, but less funny. It's.
I mean,
Yeah.
I would describe that as a feature myself, not a bug.
Okay, fine. It's feature, but it's just. It didn't interest me. I still don't.
Well, that's fair, I guess. I will say though, I like what we get to see of Floss because it's made apparent from the beginning, and even more apparent now, that for all of this big, reasonable, magnanimous seeming personality that he has, that he is perhaps not a great guy, as much as he may try to present himself as on occasion. But also, this bit at the end where he sees the box and he kind of thinks out loud about the box and what it means and what he has to do as king but is afraid to do as a person.
Right. There is. Pirates does a good job of at least being explicit when necessary, or at least implying properly the kind of difficulties of personhood versus responsibility for others, and the kind of losses that you can take. I mean, he fell into a stupor for 20 years and just withdrew from the world because of his losses, and now he's face down with a box that he has a. I'm sure he knows exactly what it is. He's done this before, so he knows the losses he's gonna take if he comes back. So when he looks at the box, he knows exactly the kind of cost it will be. And when he opens it and sees Drevish's head, he knew that this is something that was possible. And watching it happen was satisfying as fuck. Because that was the first
Yeah.
moment where I didn't quite hate Flos, because at least Pirate showed that he's aware, even if he's still gonna do all the things he's gonna do, he's still aware of the cost of it.
And ironically, he says it himself that this is a cause for war that I'm not certain he even really at that moment in time wanted. And I think that there's two things that I think are big themes across his whole story that I really captured well here. If I did not do X, I would not be worthy of being a king. In this case, it's I have to open that box and confront what I'm afraid of inside of it. And why do people keep poking me? I'm a big angry bear to war.
And this was, I believe, a bonus chapter that was written by Pirate once a certain level was reached.
Oh, yes, it was.
Yeah, that's what made it. That's why there was a sudden like shift over in POV in the original written stuff. But this was a bonus chapter. Pirate added a perspective, and people like voted for it, and they were trying to make some money off of it. Patreons, I think they hit $1,000. Oh no, they didn't. They were trying to hit certain levels of goals on their Patreon. They were still looking at like they weren't making the amount of money they are making now, certainly, but Yeah, they were just trying to get a little bit so they could pay their rent.
Can't hate that. And I actually do appreciate the letting people vote on what interests them. Sometimes it does mean that, like, it can be rough if you're a fan of a particular character or an idea that doesn't catch on with everyone else, and you know that it gets its missed and its time to shine, so to speak, gets pushed back or rolled into another chapter or backstory. But I mean, for the most part, I mean, you got to make money, and I think that this is a great ethical way of doing it.
There is one. Okay. Do you mind if I move on to comments, or do you want to? Because there's something really important that I want to bring up as a topic.
No.
Okay. So, the false chapter, usual stuff, Dragonus is actually has a measured critique and ideas, and I'm just being salty. But there is some fun comments. Aside, Pirate just author notes mostly about the how nervous they were introducing a new perspective. But in the comment section, people like they defined pirate with a particular gender, and there was a little bit of a back and forth, and then Pirate says, "I could be like Jennifer Miller, or I could be a wig and beard collector. I'm deep, or at least I claim to be. I try to keep gender and personal information private because the author isn't as important as the story. Plus, I don't like attention." So two things there: one, Pirate doesn't like attention. Okay, sure. I mean, they stream so that they can improve their writing. Somehow that feels like attention seeking. That's not a criticism. It's just that's it. It is what it is. You're seeking validation from others whenever you're doing a creative work. It's this weird juxtaposition of I don't want people to know me, but I want people to know my soul through my writing. But I say that, but that's not really the important part for me. The important part for me is a pirate has always kept their gender and their personal information as private as possible. I'm sure there's people who have tracked it down. And I bring this topic up because I think it's a reflection of the times. It used that someone can do this. It used to be that you had, like, whether you were female or male, depending on what you wrote and which publishing house you were with, they would decide what personal details to let out. Because oftentimes female writers would have to use male pen names, and if you were a male writer writing a romance, you had to use a female pen name. There, or you,
Or
go ahead.
creative use of initials so people can draw their own conclusions. And it's not even, I don't think, specific to publishing houses. I remember hearing or reading something Wildbow, who wrote Worm, said way back when he was still writing that, about how, like, because he was writing a story about a female main character from her point of view, he was nervous and kind of felt like he was uncertain how to tell people that he was a guy because a lot of people were assuming that he was a woman
Yeah,
when
because
writing it.
there's an assumption that depending on what gender you are, what background you come from, where you live, where you grow up, that's what you'll write. And I mean, there is some truth to that. You write what you know, right? But a good writer, what makes a good writer is somebody who's able to understand the perspective of others and reflect it back properly and comment on it through their own lens without diminishing the person or the object or the theme that you're commenting on. A good writer can write a lot of things. They might not be able to write it perfectly or well, and they may feel like they don't do it as much justice, and that's fair, but a good writer writes. That's the whole point. I remember a few years ago, sorry, go ahead. You
Oh no, go on, go on.
I remember a few years ago, I was reading a blog post from a particular writer. A question was asked by one of the commenters, "Would you ever consider writing about this particular pair of people as main characters? Because I would love to see you write gay a pair for a gay voice." And the response was really measured, and it came down to, we are a couple, and we live in the writers are a couple, and we live in Texas, and we've lived a long life together, and we know all of these experiences, and we can write about it, but it wouldn't be real, and in a truthful way, it wouldn't speak to your experiences. We'd have to do the kind of research, and if we did, it would have to be the kind of secondhand writing that's not necessarily great, especially because the genre they were particularly writing in was all about emotions and mental, like, personal connections. And when you're speaking to that, when you're characterizing someone, you need to be able to be inside of that person's to reflect back in your writing properly. And one of the things I promise I have a point to this. The point of this pirate app is anonymity lets all of the readers kind of reflect their own thoughts onto pirate the persona, and there is this wealth of goodwill that comes from that, because nobody makes assumptions, or at least they shouldn't make assumptions, right? And that'll
Oh, I mean, I think everybody makes assumptions, but I think that that is inevitable that everybody will have their mental image of pirate, and it may shift. I have a mental image of pirate that's changed a lot, actually, and continues to change. I can't stop myself from having it.
Yeah, and that, but the point being that mental image, that anonymity helped Pirate as a writer because they're able to explore things in a more true way. We know, I will say this, we don't know their gender or anything, but they have stated that they were uncomfortable writing about queer themes or trans themes because they felt like, from their experience, they weren't pr being going to be able to properly reflect it. I don't know. Is this a spoiler alert point if I talk about it?
I mean that alone I don't think is a spoiler, and like I mean it's obvious that at some point, you know, Pirate is going to explore that because Pirate at some point, you know, wants to touch a little bit at least on everything.
Yeah,
And
but they do touch on different themes and different ideas, and they take the care to do it well, and they don't try to talk down to anybody, and they do it in every aspect. I mean, mental health, all of these themes that are talked about doesn't necessarily mean that pirate themselves experience it, but it does mean that they understand it and they took the time to read it. And I really, really appreciate that. I guess that's the thesis of what I'm trying to say,
or at least try.
right?
But yeah, what I was gonna say, what you said earlier though, is I don't know if I would like say that in order to be a good writer, you have to write outside of what you know. I think that there is a perfectly fair, reasonable world where Pirate says, you know what? Hypothetically speaking, I'm straight. And I'm worried that if I try and like write gay queer themes, that it's going to go horribly wrong because I don't understand it. I don't want to make people uncomfortable. I don't want to take the story down this direction. Obviously, I'll still have gay, trans, queer characters, but like the themes overall probably won't be a big prominent thing. And if we lived in that world, I would say that's perfectly fair, and I wouldn't have to like it, but I do think I'd have to respect it. I don't think it's a requirement to be a good writer to do it.
Maybe I misspoke. I probably did misspeak. I tend to babble, but I don't mean that you need the requirement. I mean, it's possible for a writer. It should
Oh, yeah,
be.
it's
Like, it
possible.
should be something that you're not afraid of, because it really isn't something to be feared, right? It's.
I disagree. I think it is absolutely something to be feared sometimes.
I don't know.
But I also think that like where it works best is when you do get somebody who is willing to approach other people and genuinely work for their perspectives. And of course, that works best as your audience grows and you get more people you can ask, or, you know, before you're big, just making the effort to find spaces, approach them politely, and say, hey, I'm writing X, can I get some advice? But that itself is almost its own entire set, own entire skill set that can be difficult to really pull out.
Yeah. Okay, I went down a whole tangent, but I thought it was important to address because, I mean, it's a big deal about pirate, and we never really, I mean, we talk about it, we mention it, but we don't really address it.
Honestly, given pirates' preference for privacy, I often get worried about even just bringing up their preference for privacy, you know, let their privacy be private.
I feel the same way. It's just, I, this is,
I'm an anxious person,
yeah.
though, so, like, you know, don't look at me.
I'm stuttering so much. I thought it was
But.
important to bring up, if only because at some point you have to address the elephant in the room. And the fact is that Pirate Abba does not communicate through voice or image or any of the stuff. Like, Other writers do. They maintain anonymity and they allow the internet to create a persona, and it's a whole thing.
It does make them something of a blank slate, which makes it a lot easier to sort of feel like whenever they tackle a new perspective or subject that,
They're writing
you're
for
not
you.
immediate.
They're writing for you.
But well, I was going to say that you're not immediately thinking to yourself, ah, well, this romance novel has a guy's name on it, and this sci-fi novel has a woman's name on it,
Right.
and I'm now going to read them with a sense of judgment in my brain.
Oh my God.
That's switched off. Still, I have been thinking about what a good question for this one would be, and I am actually having a little bit of trouble with it until I had a thought.
Okay.
Now, I'm trying to find the right way to word this one because I don't want to do any spoilers, but I was thinking about what you would cook if you had wondrous fare.
Oh, I see. What would you make with your ability to like? And let's be clear here. This is true magic. So stop thinking about it in terms of like stat buffs or shrinking food or whatever the hell it is. Think Alice in Wonderland levels of absurdity, where whatever food you create will do whatever effect you want.
I just want to make souffles so light and fluffy that they never collapse, and if you eat it, you float home.
Oh my God, I keep thinking about tea on the ceiling in for Mary Poppins, and I would want tea that lets me fly. Or at least float. Like I know the whole scene in Mary Poppins was basically a way for them to secretly incept the fact that you can get high at parties, but it's still like, I mean, that's what it was. Disney was teaching you how to get high at parties. But yeah, that's all it was. That's what I want. Like, a way to get high. Okay, you know what? Fuck that all. I know what I would make. I would make candy that okay, that this is super personal, but I don't care. I'm fine with sharing my life. Candy that douches you out perfectly. That preps you. That's what I would make.
And folks, on that note, I do think it is time to say goodnight. Thank you for listening to another wonderful episode of No Killing Novels.
Everybody.
Bye.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins. The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin, or email us at nokillinggoblins@gmail.com.
Edited by Liquid Ender.